Liebe Antje.
Dear Antje, ladies and gentlemen, allow me to speak in German. I'm sure you will be able to better understand me if I speak in German. Now, this is the end of day two, and I only witnessed day two. It was an extremely instructive event, which got one message across. It's going to be really difficult to bring the level of cognition and the level of discourses on that to a controllable and diagnostically rich way and level. Although I've been involved in this field for quite some years and looked at Harun Farooqi's films, and I'm incapable of reconciling this already today or tonight. And if I listen to the film theorists, I just have an inkling that it won't take that much time until cultural scientists will have found conference formats which will really allow them to work seriously on these topics. Nevertheless, allow me to contrast the various discourses which we can control and the cognition which we need to embrace or want to embrace. And allow me to focus on the task which I was entrusted with, i.e. talk about the relation of capital or property capital and work from my personal perspective. I'm going to break my presentation down into three different points. I'm going to focus on individual authors, first of all, Melville and The Confidence Man. Number two, Karl Marx and the work value theory. And since we're talking about the system theory, we're going to talk about Niklas Luhmann and the theorem of functional differentiation. I don't know in how far the confidence game you're familiar, or in how far you're familiar with the confidence game. I'm sure the literature scientists are familiar with it. It's the last big narration by Herman Melville, was published in 45. First of April, Mississippi steamboat. There was a confidence man, i.e., a con man, and gradually, he kind of cons all the various passengers on that steamboat and rips them off, steals certain valuables from them. So what's so interesting about the confidence games is that it's always about trickster games, which are perpetrated by two tricksters and one victim. And that's what Melville's narration is all about, two con men. Contact a victim, tell them some story in order to pinch their watch, to rip them off, by make them give a donation. And then the victim is kind of lulled into the treacherous discourse and only finds out too late, finds out that the watch is gone or something else was lost or the price was too low. They get excited, look around, try to find a policeman, try to find a neighbor with whom they want to talk about how terribly they were ripped off. And then suddenly the second con man contacts them and tells them, "Why? What happened? Tell me what happened to you." And then he tells them, the victim is outraged and tells about all the things that happened to them. And of course the second con man has lots of tricks. And the key trick is, you want to contact the police with that story? You want to tell this story to your friend? You will be the ridicule of everyone, because that's going to backfire on you. I mean, it's not going to backfire on the person who ripped you off. Don't you want to remain silent on this? You became a victim. Don't you want to learn the lesson and never become a victim again? And this is the only precondition under which the police is not alerted. This is the only precondition under which this story is not spread. And this is the only precondition which allows the first con man to continue engaging in their tricksters. On the steamboat. Erwin Goffman, this was one of the most important sociologists of last century, almost 100 years later, 1952, wrote an essay where it was about confidence game, cooling the mark out, i.e. the mark is the victim. How can you cool them down? And he came to the conclusion that the American society, and probably also modern society in general, can be described as a society which potentially no longer has the first con man, but only consists of the second type of con man. So we're constantly cooled off. We're constantly reassured that, okay, you've been ripped off. And people always tell us, well, learn something, become better citizens of your society. I think that tells us quite a lot about the relationship about workers and capitalists. And it's more telling than can be found in lots of theories. So I think the worker who is coerced into delivering a value added to the first con man, and then he then falls prey to the economists of this world, the sociologists of this world, the politicians of this world, who reassure them, the politicians tell and so on, tell them, well, you've been ripped off, but I mean, these are relations where you didn't fare too bad. You could still earn a living for your livelihood, and we will see this later on in the film. Frequently, you're living under conditions where you have a professional ethic, you have enjoyment with your colleagues. Well, I mean, exaggerating, okay. And at the end of the day, that ensures your successful participation in that very society. So if that is the case, that our working theories, our theories of work, are subject to the second con man type of theory, well, so it's kind of reassurance. And that if we have the feeling that we are not really sure whether we've been ripped off or whether we just deserts, because I mean, this is also a legitimate hypothesis which you might put up for grabs. Do we really earn what we earn? Do we deserve what we deserve? And is maybe those people who coerce us, are they just better or more clever? Are they more brilliant than us? So are they just more capable? So we are caught in that catch-22. We're moving in that situation. And we keep asking ourselves, well, you know, that theory, workers are being exploited by capital, is that illegitimate? And this brings me to chapter number two. The first big attempt of doing the arithmetics of, you know, working out the value added which is delivered by workers and which is then appropriated by capital owners was prepared by Karl Marx. Karl Marx did a formidable exercise because he was the very first who analyzed economic action, activity, management. Okay, well, he didn't talk about management, but let's talk about economic activity and work. So Karl Marx was the first one who attributed an exclusive social determination to work. Marx was perhaps the person who wrote the first social theory of work. Marx was the one who no longer thought we work because we need to make do with the scarcity of resources of nature. We're not working because this is within our anthropological makeup. We can't, you know, just sit on our settee. But Marx said, my theory is that we work because we are interested in utilitarian value, and we can access this utilitarian value if we can produce something which we can offer to others who can offer us the utilitarian. So Marx developed a social theory of value, which fatally for the working market theory for Marx banked on a difference, the useful value and the actual value or the exchange value, and the consequence is that the exchange value can only be assessed individually by the individual, i.e., am I prepared to pay that price or am I not prepared to pay that price which is asked for certain services or goods? And the consequence of that was that the exchange value is then enshrined in individual cost-benefit analyses, which are not exactly synonymous with utilitarian value, which cannot be compared, which cannot be aggregated into something like social welfare concepts and social well-being concepts for everyone, but which lead to a situation where the economic endeavors of society at every individual point, at every individual transaction, when you borrow something, when you sign a labor contract, when you sign a purchase contract, diverges into two incompatible halves, namely the cost-benefit analysis of the individual and the cost which are expended in order to produce the respective or to make the respective product available. This has had a number of economic consequences, which are precisely this key problem, the non-aggregation capacity of the utilitarian value and the cost-benefit analysis, and this leads to a macroeconomic total balance. And that would be a good thing if you had this. I mean, what about the generated value of added of a society, and how far can we compensate those who feel exploited for their readiness to become involved in this entire game? So if there was this macroeconomic welfare balance, or and if there is no such well-being, or if you can't work it out in an aggregated way mathematically, if you can only claim it ideologically, then you no longer have the possibility of coming up with an economic compensation between work and capital. You can no longer can use it to justify the relations, and you cannot come up with a work value theory which is based on a social level, or which can be anchored at a social level. And that brings me to the third chapter, Niklas Luhmann. Sociological system theory tries to respond to this deficit. The loss of a uniform benchmark for the value is what it responds to, for the value per se, the value of the work, by introducing system benchmarks, references. I mean, this is still outrageous. It's still very, very theoretical and rarefied, and either you buy it or you don't. Either you study it or you don't. But still, it's a variant of describing societies, amongst many other variants of describing. But this is my theory for tonight. In this context of coming up with a value theory for work and production, it's an interesting attempt which is being made by system theory here under Niklas Luhmann. Now, let's assume you can't formulate a general value theory. Let's assume that the social theory which Marx was looking for, of the value for work, failed. Then this begs the following question. Which system benchmarks are capable, are fit for the purposes of describing the construction of a value? And this is what's so intriguing about Niklas Luhmann. He comes up with a one by one of the system theory. We can decline it, come up with, work it through, and I'm going to do this. And then you can decide whether you're interested in it or not. So 101 of system theory by Niklas Luhmann. Niklas Luhmann has three different ways of coming up with system benchmarks. Either interaction, I mean, what happens amongst those who are present. I mean, you see me, I see you not quite as well, but we all see each other, and this creates a certain kind of communication and interaction and a scope for action which is possible here. Then organization, communication amongst people who are absent, but as member of the same organization, they are being considered with those, by those with whom you can cooperate in order to work on certain products, and then the society and the production systems. And secondly, you can also do a second equation if you take your cue from Luhmann. Taking the value theory as a theory on the level of the senses, i.e. what makes sense for whom and which sense. And again, there's three options available to you. There is a factual sense. What is the benefit of a bottle of water, which I see here? There is a social sense. Can I talk with you about a bottle of water? Probably not. Best not now. And there is a temporal meaning. Maybe later I can get back to this bottle of water and drink it, because I don't have something, have time for this. I mean, factual, social, etc. And this has different dimensions. And you may ask, what is the interrelation of one dimension to the next? And how can you make sure that the factual assessments diverge between the stakeholders, the temporal assessments diverge. I mean, some people think in shorter time horizons, others think in long time horizons, or others don't think at all. Maybe they're spontaneous. And then the social difference. How do you handle it yourself? The social difference itself. Harun shot a wonderful film on that, a new product. Which are the forms which we developed in order to make the different deltas, deviations from the work processes communicable in the work processes and via the work processes. Yes, okay, take team production, for instance. Sometimes you have team productions where everybody is in the same boat. Everybody who was on a team sometimes knows that the opposite is the case. Not everybody is on board, and that the production of the product, which teams are involved with, are exactly the result of this conflict, the friction of having to have this antagonist cooperative form. So there is the result of the antagonist friction. So there are these three dimensions. I'm going to leave the sense dimension outside for the time being. So let's walk through these three different benchmarks. Then you may ask the question, what is the value of a work of the interaction? And then you can say, okay, let's have a look at different interactions of workers at the workplace, or interactions of consumers of products in their respective families or in their single family households. Okay, there's not an awful lot of communication going on there, or something that was always given short shrift at Marx. There were two things which were given short shrift at Marx, for instance, market and management. So between workers and capital in the 19th century, hundreds and hundreds of people set up shop which only have one job, i.e. having the capital on the one side and having the workers on the other side, and benefit from that. So there are kind of go-betweens, and that this is one of the few blind spots which Marx afforded himself in his own theory, which he didn't see. And okay, consumers were not very prevalent, but maybe they were not so conspicuous in the 19th century. Anyway, the value inherent in a work consists in the way in which working colleagues deal with each other, regardless of the of the sadness of their working conditions, regardless of the economically precarious relations under which they live. For instance, the dry cleaner, which we just saw. You don't want to know which kind of diseases he's already carrying around with him. So regardless of the precariousness, that's what we saw in lots of the other films, for instance, where the martyr bottle was being handed around in a previous panel. This is also what was shown there. So regardless of this, there are certain moments of stylization and recognition of what we can call working culture, where the product itself plays an important role. And even though it's very marginal, even though it's maybe the cleaning gang, or maybe it's the clean city on which the cleaners work, or the garbage men, I'm going to leave the consumers aside because they're not quite at the focus of our interest, but managers, of course, have an appreciation of the product. And contrary to the workers, their appreciation is that every value of a working product is gauged against ways in which it can be changed in order to reduce costs, increase quality, make them accessible to a different consumer group, etc. So the manager or the management is the party which always has to have a look at the value for its variability. Of course, this is not dealt with in the film here, but for the topic of our discussion and for capitalism, it's a really pivotal point. Organization, I'm not going to belabor that point because it would be too comprehensive and I don't have enough time, but suffice it to say, in organizations, the things become valorized as work, which are simultaneously the result of blocking action and getting action, was what Helvetz once said. An organization is an establishment which prevents 99% of what the workers could do. So the 1% which you need is being insured. Usually we don't pay attention to that. We don't pay attention to the fact that workers in an organization, not just management or senior management, but every member of an organization prevents member or their colleagues to come up with ideas which are unnecessary. But this is the day-to-day work in an organization. And only in this day-to-day work can you establish the ideas, the routines which you really need. and promote them. So constantly there is stifling of any possible possibilities, like who might be intriguing. Just imagine 50 people together, and sometimes you have organizations where 50,000 people are being organized. Or just think about the potential of values which they could create. But routinely this is being stifled with a very purposeful action. It's being prevented just to make sure that a limited amount of values, which are the historical result of the establishment of this organization, which were never explicitly agreed, but which are just the result of the historical organization. So this becomes a contrast to a horizon of non-produced value. And therefore, it does not take wonder that the that society looks at organizations and asks itself, why don't we have these wonderful organizations if they can't really come up with things which we really need, like a green production, etc. And actually, I would have to reduce 101 even further, the functional systems, those politics, economy, mass media, religion, etc. All of these systems, if you look closely, are systems where which have their own value precepts, value understanding. The economy looks for values exclusively, namely for values which can be made scarce so that you can produce them on a regular basis, because the economy can only sell what other people think is scarce, and therefore you need to come up with values which lend themselves towards a scarcity so you can produce them, and so you get buyers who think, well, okay, this is a scarce resource and therefore I should better pay money to buy this. And maybe potentially they are not that scarce, but at least that you need to have that idea. So the economy is not something that tries to remedy the scarce nature and extract those few things which the nature can offer. But this is what we know from Marx. The economy is exactly that system which covers the entire gamut of the available resources and scans the available resources and has a look at potential for creating scarcity in order to create value added. For instance, good air. If you create scarcity, then in order to really recover your lungs, you need to go on an expensive holiday. And what does politics make? They constantly look for classes of goods which are not being produced by the classes which I just mentioned, the public goods which are being funded by politics or funded by tax. It looks for time horizons which may be barren. It looks at an economic area or sector, sees that products which are deemed as scarce, for instance, looks at environmental protection. There is an endangerment of the sustainable regeneration possibilities of society, and therefore politicians then intervene. Politicians add a second codification of values in order to remedy the first codification of the economy, and vice versa. Of course, it works both ways. The economy looks at politicians and sees which things are deemed necessary or useful, like solar energy, and then they move into that sector and find out, well, actually, it's not really that scarce. Or law is such an interesting system, and actually we've been giving short shrift to it here at this event. It looks at values by ensuring exclusion and inclusion possibilities. Hernando de Soto, a wonderful economist from Latin America, in recent years kept repeating this. Especially where the Western economy is based on the fact of finding legal forms of allowing to sell something to somebody, which, what, when. So without these inclusion and exclusion rights, without marking a territory, a sphere where you can produce something before you bring it to the market, the biggest value production in our society wouldn't take place in the first place. And art laments the lack of aesthetic sense for the produced goods. And art, by art mediators, offers training for reception and creativity with a completely different take on values, which of course moves into the direction into which we all want to move, i.e. what does perception tell us on our on what our needs produced in this society? And scientists come up with their own value theory, regardless of what I tell you now, like Gary S. Becker's, for instance, wonderful, elegant production theory of values, which is capable of demonstrating that values will only be produced if the quoted cost-benefit analysis, regardless of temporal spatial benefit analysis, lead to a situation where these values, corresponding values, will be in demand. So here, the values will depend on the production, both on the side of producers and consumers, just to name one example here. Then there is religion as a system. Religion comes up with additional salvation premiums and tries to add them on the production of those values, which are deemed to be, you know, welcomed by God. And then mass media look for conflicts in order to differentiate perpetrators and circumstances and create stack scandals. So it's not a wonderful world. So where are the values of society? For values of society, you've got semantics of decadence and progress, etc., which try to gain an overview. And these semantics try to reconcile the various divergent organizations and offer a kind of language where on which you can agree, at least on a case-by-case basis, in order to differentiate those things from which you deem valuable and those things which you don't deem valuable. On this note, this is the end of my presentation, and I thank you for your kind attention.